There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Previously on 22 Hours, an American nightmare.
So what would you say? Is this like fire damage still? The asphalt?
It looks like the asphalt has sort of been melted in a way.
I'm sure that there were many members of the Major Case Squad that believed that more than one individual was involved.
Investigators quickly look for the quick answer. And when they think they have it, they forget about all the other things that might be important.
It is being called a major crime scene as homicide investigators examine a house that caught fire in Northwest D.C.
The room is a crime scene.
They found four people, including a child, dead inside on the second floor.
Right now, it does not appear that this was just a random crime.
I said, but what happened? They said, we don't know. They killed the whole family.
Police have said they believe more than one person is responsible for the crime.
A wide-reaching manhunt for Darren Wint, stretching all the way to New York City.
We had the DNA on a piece of crust. How did his DNA get into that house?
Got a package that I'm going to need you to bring down to me.
To do what he did to four people, including a 10-year-old boy, is just beyond words.
They were brutalized, and we saw the evidence of that.
The jury has just reached a verdict in the murder trial of Darren Wint.
He was going to strike the American dream just by committing murder and mayhem.
This is 22 Hours, an American nightmare. A few months ago, Jack and I went out to Lanham, Maryland, where Darren Wint was living with his father and stepmother at the time of the killings. As far as we know, Darren's family still lives there. There's no doorbell? Mm-mm. Maybe she's out for a walk or something. In the months we've spent working on this podcast, we called a few members of Darren Wint's family, but we couldn't reach them. Or in a few cases, they hung up on us. We stopped by the house to make every effort to get their story, as their family was also affected by this case.
Okay, so we just tried to knock on Dennis and Pam Wint's door, and there's a car in the driveway, but we both walked up there, and there was no answer at the door, so we're not sure if she's home or he's home, or they just didn't want to answer, or what the deal is.
The house where the Wint family lives is about 2 miles away from the church parking lot where Amy Savopoulos' Porsche was found burned. 4 years ago, this quiet block was a circus. After police had identified Darren Wint as the prime suspect through the DNA on the pizza crust, they went to his last known address, his dad's house in Lanham. Darren wasn't home. By that point, he'd left town. He was hundreds of miles away. But police spent several hours searching the house, and when reporters found out, they swarmed the suburban cul-de-sac. Here's a WTOP news broadcast from that day.
This is Christy King outside the Lanham home that was searched by police looking for Darren Wint last night, and where a man and woman came out this morning and hopped into a D.C. officer's unmarked car.
This breaks my heart. It really does.
Devera Zinell lives two doors down.
Good neighbors. I've been here for over 30-some years. Good neighbors. And in fact, Mr. Wint is my plumber.
This home on Westview Lane is nestled off Good Hope Road just outside the Beltway, about a half
4 years later, the neighborhood is quiet.
It's about like 4:30. People are getting home from work. We were hoping they'd be home. Not.
So far in this podcast, we've laid out a timeline of the victim's last 22 hours. But what about Darren Wint's whereabouts in that same time period? That's what we're going to do in this episode. Lay out where he was seen and where he wasn't. A lot of this information we know because prosecutors called members of Darren's own family to testify against him. Here's what we found out. Wednesday, May 13th, 2015. Before the family was taken hostage, before the murders, before the fire, Darren Wint basically went missing. He was 34 years old and living with his father, Dennis, and stepmother, Pam, and their teenage daughter, Darren's half-sister, in the house in Lanham, Maryland. Darren was a welder by trade and had worked for a couple different metalworking places around Prince George's County, Maryland. American Ironworks, the company Sava Savopoulos ran, was one of them. But that had been years ago. He'd been fired for missing work in 2005, according to company records. More recently, Darren worked at a metalworking plant called Metal Fab. Darren learned how to be a welder from his stepfather in Guyana, where he grew up. Welding is skilled work, and it can pay well. But construction can be a difficult business. Work isn't always steady. There's a lot of competition for high-paying jobs. And by the spring of 2015, Darren hadn't held down a full-time job for a few years. Darren moved to his dad and stepmom's house in Lanham in April 2015. And by May, he had a routine. He'd usually wake up early, often he was up before the sun, and he'd hop in his old blue minivan to go look for work. There was a 7-Eleven parking lot nearby where day laborers would hang around looking for off-the-books jobs. Darren would usually be back home by 10 in the morning, not having found work. That's what his stepmother Pam Wint said when she took the stand. She was the first member of Darren Wint's family to testify. On the stand, Pam was soft-spoken, warm, motherly. She's in her late 50s, but looks much younger. She said after he came home looking for work, Darren would usually spend all day on his phone or on the computer, mostly talking to his long-distance girlfriend, Vanessa, who lived in New York. He spent hours watching movies on Netflix, too. Darren had a cheap, hand-me-down smartphone, but he didn't have a cell phone plan, so he had to use Wi-Fi to make calls and to use apps like Facebook and send text messages. It partially explains why we have such a fuzzy digital trail for Darren Wint. Investigators can usually do what's called a cell site analysis. Basically, they can tell where your phone was on a certain day and time based on which nearby cell towers it's using to send signals. But Darren's phone never pinged off any towers. Ever. It wasn't using cellular data, and it made his phone basically untraceable. In the spring of 2015, Darren was also spending hours of his day at the gym. Before his Facebook account was shut down, his profile was filled with gym selfies. He's not really a tall guy, but judging by the photos he posted on Facebook, some which the police released later, Darren was in incredible shape. Along with going to the gym and binging on Netflix every day, Darren was also hooked on playing the lottery. A family friend had given him an old laptop that he would tinker on, trying to calculate winning numbers and boost his odds of picking a winning set of numbers. Darren was a numbers guy. Maybe, he thought, one day he could outsmart the system, strike it rich. Because he had been out of work for so long, Darren was growing used to having a precarious living situation. He'd been bouncing around, staying in different places. Before he moved in with his dad, he'd been kicked out of his brother Stefan's house after a fight. His dad's house offered stability of sorts, but things weren't working out. Earlier that month, at the beginning of May 2015, Darren's dad told him he had to be out by the end of the month. In 2000, when Darren was just 19, he immigrated from Guyana, a small South American country on the continent's northern coast. The population of the entire country is less than 800,000, about the population of D.C. It borders Brazil and Venezuela, but is considered part of the Caribbean. Guyana is the only country in South America where English is the official language. Darren arrived in the U.S. with his younger brother, Stefan. His dad and stepmom sponsored him. A year later, his older sister, Samantha, came. But by May 2015, Darren's green card had expired. His stepmom was helping him fill out the complicated paperwork to get it renewed. She'd gone through the process before, having immigrated from Guyana herself. At this point, she'd lived in the U.S. for 30 years. Still, it was a frustrating and complex process, and Darren knew at some point he'd probably have to get a lawyer to sort it all out. On that Wednesday, May 13th, 2015, the day the Savopoulos family and Vera Figueroa were taken captive, Darren was nowhere to be found at his dad's house. When his stepmother Pam woke up at about 7 in the morning to get her teenage daughter ready for school, Darren was gone. His old blue minivan was not parked out front. And he didn't come home around 10 a.m. like usual. He didn't come home the whole day. His stepmom says she stayed up late that night waiting for him, and he never returned. She was worried. Nobody could reach him, and he hadn't left any word about where he was going. On Wednesday, May 13th, when he dropped off the radar, Darren's stepmom wasn't the only one worried about him. His long-distance girlfriend, Vanessa, who lived in New York City, sent him multiple unreturned messages that day. That wasn't like Darren to not respond. At 1:41 p.m., she texted, "Baby, I haven't heard from you. Hope everything is good." No response. Later that night, another message from Vanessa. "Hey, babe, I know you said not to worry about you if I don't hear from you, but can you please call me and let me know that you're okay? I love you. I just want to hear your voice to know you're okay." It wasn't just May 13th that Vanessa couldn't reach Darren. She tried again early the next morning, on May 14th. At 7:43 a.m., she texted, "Baby, just want to know that you're okay." Darren didn't respond. He never responded to any messages on May 13th or May 14th. Over the 22 hours when Sava, Amy, and Philip Savopoulos and Vera Figueroa were being held hostage, tortured, and then beaten and stabbed to death, Darren Wint's normally active Facebook account went dark.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
During the trial, prosecutors showed the jury this big chart they made, tracking how many Facebook messages Darren typically sent in a day. He was normally sending dozens, sometimes more than 100. He didn't really use email or text. He pretty much exclusively used Facebook to communicate with everyone. But for most of the day, May 13th and 14th, nothing. From nearly 100 messages a day to nothing. Prosecutors said from 6 in the morning on that Wednesday until after 6 Thursday evening, an entire 36 hours, Darren's Facebook records show no activity. And the timestamp 6 p.m. on Thursday is kind of key. That's just 30 minutes after Amy's Porsche was found set on fire. It's at that point Darren Wint's Facebook activity seemed to return to normal. He started sending a stream of messages again, like usual. One of them was to his other half-sister, Onika, back in Guyana. She'd messaged him earlier that day, wanting to know how things were going for her big brother. "Everything good?" she'd asked. Darren finally responded a little before 7 that evening, about an hour and a half after the Porsche was found on fire. "Yeah," he said. "I think." When Darren returned back home to his father's house in Lanham, his dad was furious. "We were worried about you," he told Darren. "If you're going to be out all night, you need to let us know." On the stand, his stepmother said, Darren didn't say where he'd been. She remembered him saying something like he just didn't feel like coming home. "I'm stressed out," he said. "I don't have a job." Later that night, Darren also made contact with Vanessa. We don't know what explanation he gave her for why he went radio silent for more than a day and a half. She testified at the trial, but she didn't share what Darren told her, or Dylan, as she knew him. All she said was that he sounded normal on the phone. Then, a few hours after they talked that evening, Darren messaged Vanessa a photo. It's a picture of two white iPhones. They are identical to Sava and Amy's white iPhones. They were the phones investigators said were used to make all those calls while the family and Vera were being held hostage. The two white iPhones that no one could find inside the house. On the call, Darren asked Vanessa if she thought the phones could be traced. She said yes, she thinks they can be traced. And at some point that night, Darren deleted the photo of the two iPhones. The chart showing that Darren's Facebook activity went silent for most of May 13th and 14th is not solid proof of anything. It was circumstantial evidence, but it was persuasive. Recognizing that, Darren Wint's defense attorneys tried to have it suppressed from being introduced at trial. They argued it wasn't relevant. The judge disagreed. And it turns out there were other, even more damning pieces of circumstantial evidence, including what Darren searched for on his phone. His search activity in the days after the murders was presented in pages and pages of these confusing spreadsheets that would make your eyes cross if you looked too closely. They were introduced as evidence, given to the jury, and we got a copy from the U.S. Attorney's Office. The way they were presented, the searches weren't chronological, and there were a lot of things that were redacted. Jack and I went through all the documents that we had, unscrambled it all, and here's what we came up with.
So first, a little before 7 that evening on May 14th, several hours after the fire started at the Savopoulos house, Darren was back in Lanham searching on that old hand-me-down LG phone that he had, but he's searching for information about iPhones. He wants to know if an iPhone 6 has a memory card. And then, a few minutes later, he searches for how to master reset an iPhone 6. And remember, both Amy and Sava's missing iPhones were iPhone 6s.
So then, about an hour later, at 8:08 that night, Darren used his phone to search the phrase, how to beat a lie detector. Later on the 14th, hours after firefighters pulled the four bodies from the Savopoulos house onto the front lawn, Darren's at his dad's house and starts looking up news clips on his phone, looking specifically for that crime.
So at 12:33 a.m., he searched Tonight News Fire on Woodland Avenue. And then right after that, he searched Channel 9 News Last Night House Fire, and then searched video of four people died in house fire tonight.
So a minute later, Darren searches Channel 9 again. But this time, he types in Channel 9 News Savage Vocalist Die. That phrase obviously makes no sense. But we were thinking, what if his phone auto-corrected what he was typing? Was he trying to type Savopoulos and the phone changed it to Savage Vocalist? The attorneys never mentioned this particular search during the trial. But as we were pouring through all of the searches Darren did and laying it out in this Google Doc, this one search stood out to us. Savage Vocalist? But then Jack had an aha moment.
And it goes to the timing of this search, because if Savage Vocalist is a reference to the family, at the time Darren is searching for this, their name had not been put out there. The police had not publicly identified the victims. It wasn't until the next day that the police said the Savopoulos name.
I mean, the day before police are even saying the name, Darren searching on his phone, possibly for Savopoulos.
And that was the last search that night. But the next morning, around 9:14 a.m., Darren picks up his phone again and starts obsessively searching for news about the fire on Woodland Drive.
The day after the fire, May 15th, Darren exchanges a few texts with a man named Derek Ayling. He went by Godfrey. He was dating Darren's older sister. Darren and Godfrey were friendly. They clicked. They used to be steady workout buddies when Darren lived with them, and it was Godfrey who gave Darren his old laptop that he used to try and calculate lottery numbers. That night, they decided to go work out at Retro Fitness in New Carrollton, like old times. Godfrey picked Darren up at his dad's house, and they hit the gym. While they were there, Darren pulled out a wad of cash and showed it to Godfrey. He said it was $1,200. Godfrey'd never seen Darren with that much money. Darren told him he won the lottery. After working out that night, Godfrey dropped Darren back at his dad's house. About an hour later, a little after 11 p.m., Darren called Godfrey using Facebook Messenger. He said he needed a favor, but at first, Darren didn't want to talk about it on the phone. Godfrey was instantly suspicious. He wondered what kind of favor Darren could need that late at night that he couldn't talk about on the phone. He said he couldn't help him unless Darren told him. So Darren did. He needed help setting his van on fire. Darren said he had a problem. He was driving earlier when he sideswiped a car, and then he drove off. But why did that mean he had to burn it? Darren said he was afraid the police were looking for his van after the fender bender, and he wanted Ayling to help him get rid of it. Godfrey Ayling also testified at Darren's trial. Prosecutors asked him whether he helped Darren burn the van. No, Godfrey said he didn't. He couldn't do that. That's a layer too deep for me, he said on the stand. I don't roll like that. The next morning, Darren's stepmom noticed Darren's minivan wasn't parked out front like usual. But Darren didn't seem to be concerned. He told his dad and stepmom he wasn't planning to call the police about his missing van. Darren's van wasn't stolen. It was at a county impound lot, or what was left of it. Firefighters found the blue minivan engulfed in flames near an industrial park the night before. The next day, 3 days after the Savopoulos family's home went up in flames and four people were found dead inside, Darren Wint hopped on a bus with cash in hand, headed to New York to see Vanessa. Okay, where are we going first?
Okay, we should go to 24th and K Street. So 2400, wait, do you put GPS?
Yeah. A few months ago, Jack and I jumped in the car and drove out to some of the key locations involved in the case against Darren Wint. 24th and K Streets is in downtown D.C. It's actually just off of Pennsylvania Avenue. But no, it's not really near the White House, if you are wondering. That address, 24th and K, it has to do with where Darren's blue 2002 Ford Windstar minivan was parked on the day of the murders. Remember how we told you there are rabbit holes in this case that are really easy to get lost in? Well, Darren's van is one of those rabbit holes. You've been warned.
24th and K.
Which there's a lot of mystery surrounding this because, if you remember, in the closing arguments, the prosecutor, Lauren Bach, told the jury, basically, we're never going to know why he parked his van there. And we don't know exactly when he parked the van there. But we know after the fire at the Savopoulos mansion, Darren went back to that, to 24th and K, to pick up his blue minivan.
I like, too, that she said, remember, she was like, there's a lot of things that aren't going to make sense. And if you're trying to figure out how the van got to 24th and K, I can't help you. Remember, she was like, right. I'm paraphrasing, but she said something, she was like, you're never going to know, or we're never going to know, or something like that. It was, like, very blunt, but also effective. Like, there's so many things in this case that just we just can't ever know what happened, unless Darren tells us, and clearly that wasn't in the cards.
The location of Darren Wint's van matters, because if we line up everything we know of the timeline, it seems he left the Savopoulos house, parked his van in downtown D.C., and then somehow got back to the house before it was set on fire. Okay, this can get confusing, so we're going to unpack it for you. What's the evidence that suggests this? Let's go back to the timeline. Sava's assistant, Jordan Wallace, drops off the $40,000 at 10:26 a.m. on May 14th. Then, just about an hour later, at 11:47 a.m., Darren types 24 and K into his phone. But he doesn't type it into GPS like he's going there. He types it into a blank Facebook Messenger chat. It's almost like he's noting the location so he can reference it later. Again, prosecutors couldn't explain it, but it seems like Darren was near that intersection and had Sava's phone, because 10 minutes later, at 11:54 a.m., Sava's phone pings off a cell tower in DuPont Circle, a D.C. neighborhood about halfway between 24th and K and the Savopoulos house, so the drive time works out. And we know shortly after noon, a man who looked just like Darren, wearing a drawstring backpack, was seen slipping into the garage by those two workers at the Australian ambassador's residence across the street. When we got to 24th and K that day, we spent some time just walking around, trying to figure out, if we even could, where he might have parked the van.
So we'll go this way?
So it's just like condos, university buildings, and what look like just office buildings slash doctor's offices.
Right.
24th and K is in the Foggy Bottom neighborhood of D.C., near George Washington University. And that will become more relevant later. As we walked around that day, months after the trial, you can hear in our voices that some parts of this case were driving us crazy. Like the whole van thing. Darren moving the van and then going back to the house.
The timing of it is interesting, too. Like, why then?
Right. Well, I guess trying to make it fit in the timeline, the money drop happened. We believe that they were killed after the money drop. And, you know, I mean, it's entirely possible, you know, you've just committed four murders. You're not
and you're trying to get away with it, you're not thinking exactly clearly.
But you'd think that if that was planned, you would plan how the hell you were going to get out of it.
Well, it wasn't exactly planned that well.
So there's more to this whole van thing. We've already told you that just minutes after firefighters raced to Woodland Drive on May 14th, Amy Savopoulos' blue Porsche was spotted on the other side of D.C., racing into Maryland. There's a witness who saw it, and we'll talk more about that later. The Porsche was also caught on traffic cameras, and investigators later used those traffic cameras to track the route the Porsche took that afternoon. At 1:45, just about 15 minutes after the 911 call came in about the fire, we see the Porsche right at the D.C. line, heading into Prince George's County, Maryland, where it would later be found burned in that parking lot near the church and LaFontaine Blue Shopping Center. The traffic cameras also picked something else up later that day, a tow truck driving from Prince George's County into downtown D.C. Prosecutors actually tracked down that tow truck driver. No small feat. When he took the stand, Douglas Ventura needed a Spanish translator to understand the attorney's questions. He told them he remembered a man flagging him down that day off Annapolis Road in Prince George's County. But, he said, his memory was a little fuzzy. He picked up a lot of work on Annapolis Road. It's why he was waiting there. And he couldn't recall much about the man who flagged him down. Even looking at the defendant across the courtroom, he couldn't say for sure whether it was Darren Wendt. But prosecutors knew it was Darren because he borrowed the tow truck driver's phone during the trip to D.C. and made a whole series of calls. Darren called his dad, his stepmom, his sister, and his younger brother, Darrell. He sent text messages, too. In a text to Darrell, he misspelled his own name. He wrote, "Is Farron. Call me now. Need to talk." When he took the stand, Douglas Ventura testified, Darren gave him directions that led right to 24th and K, right to the van, and asked him to tow it back to that parking lot in Prince George's County.
En 2015, no sé si tú estuviste en la corte con un muchacho que se llama Darren Wendt.
When we were putting this podcast together, we contacted Douglas Ventura. Our colleague, Carlos Prieto, called to ask if he wanted to talk with us about his testimony. But we also had a few other questions, like, did he remember anything odd about the blue minivan? Or anything about how Darren was acting? But Ventura said he didn't really remember and wasn't interested in talking with us. Even if he had a perfect memory and he wanted to talk with us, Douglas Ventura couldn't tell us why Darren returned to this one parking lot. But prosecutors said the answer is simple. It's an area he knew well. Darren used to live right there. In fact, the walkway through the thick brush behind that parking lot leads to the apartment complex where Darren lived with Godfrey and his sister for years. Darren has a very different reason for why he was there. We'll tell you his explanation later on. We want to pull back the curtain a little bit and tell you how this podcast came together. All of this evidence that we've been laying out for you over the past several episodes was the result of years of investigation by police and prosecutors as they pieced together their case against Darren Wendt. When the trial finally began in September 2018, it had been more than 3 years since the killings. And other than some court filings and a few pre-trial hearings, it had been years since we had any new information in the case. With the trial starting, we were all finally going to hear how this crime unfolded and what the man charged, or at least his lawyers, had to say. Here's my report for WTOP from D.C. Superior Court.
Ahead of the jury questions, the defense team for 37-year-old Darren Wendt and prosecutors shed light on some of the evidence they plan to present during the two-month trial in the killings of Savas and Amy Savopoulos, their 10-year-old son Philip, and housekeeper Vera Figueroa. Surprisingly, the prosecution plans to call members of Wendt's family, multiple DNA experts, and review data from Wendt's Facebook activity. Wearing a yellow tie, his dreadlocks hanging down his back, Wendt introduced himself to the 80 potential jurors.
Jack and I found ourselves immersed in covering this trial. Stepping inside the courtroom each day was like stepping into a separate, sealed-off world, where the only thing that mattered was who was testifying that day and what new revelations about the case would emerge. Each morning, waiting for the judge and the jury to file in, we'd catch up with the other reporters in the gallery. Sava and Amy's parents were usually there every day, sitting in the same spot in the first row. And we gave them space. We also got used to seeing the same group of trial watchers,
Some looked like law students. Others were from the U.S. attorney or public defender's offices. And some curious onlookers were pretty curious themselves. On the day of closing arguments, one of the regulars showed up wearing costumed judge's robes. A few days into the trial, we decided to start recording what ended up becoming basically audio diaries of each day in court. You've heard some of those recordings before. Recording audio or video is not permitted inside D.C. Superior Court. So I had to relay the details of testimony within the short time I had to file four radio pieces when we got a break from court during the day. For most of the six-week trial, Jack was back in the WTOP newsroom, and I was inside courtroom 203. When there was a 15-minute break, before I had to file my midday reports at lunch, or when we broke at the end of the day, I would run outside and call Jack to debrief him on what came out in court, so we were on the same page of what to report that day and so that we didn't mess up any of the details. At first, we were just trying to keep up with the flood of evidence and testimony. But these calls ended up becoming an interesting record of how we experienced this trial. Not surprisingly, given what you know about the gaps in the timeline, we spent a lot of time on the phone trying to sort it out. Like what happened before the workers of the Australian ambassador's residence across the street saw Darren dipping into the garage around noon on May 14th.
Him arriving at the scene is just so weird to me, because where would he have gone?
If you're the prosecution, you have him going into the house an hour before the fire is set, and you don't have him leaving. So it looks like he did it.
A lot of our conversations revolved around the forensic evidence we told you about in the last episode. We were struggling to keep up with the science of it at times, and we wondered how the detail of Emily Head's testimony played with the jury.
So she kind of just laid things out, like, she just, you know, what are the steps you go through to examine DNA? What is the serology result? And then they finally started getting into the case.
So real quickly, what is the difference between DNA and serology?
I don't understand it, Jack.
But serology would have to be blood, right?
Yeah, I think, like, she used the example of the bat and it looked like there was staining on it.
Some days, the evidence that once seemed so cut and dried seemed to become more confusing.
Everything is getting so murky. Like when you just focus on the broad brush and you say, oh, his DNA was found on five things, including the pizza. But then when you start looking at all these things, it just becomes, the picture does not become clearer. It actually becomes more kind of obscured. Like why would his DNA be on, why would there be two things of DNA on bite marks of pizza?
Covering this trial was exhausting, I have to admit. Some days were newsworthy and packed with things to report, and other days were slower or just made complicated for silly reasons, like when it rained or the security line was ridiculously long.
I want to let you know the fire alarm is going off in D.C. Superior Court right now.
Some days, a little silliness was the way we kept ourselves sane around the courtroom.
This is Megan Clougherty. I am stuck in the basement courtroom cafe, as I always am.
But other days were heavy, and I couldn't stop thinking about what was happening inside courtroom 203.
Laura Bach had this point where she took out Sava's clothes to show how many holes were in his shirt, which were like the stab wounds, and she put her finger through one of the holes in the shirt. And then two minutes later, the whole courtroom smelled like dead body.
Like, what did that smell like?
I don't know if you've ever been on a crime scene, but it's like this like sort of sweet, foul, it's just a horrible smell. And it was like throughout the whole courtroom because his clothes smelled like that.
Okay.
So I have to run back in there, but like I'm like, oh my god. Like Bach, when she was talking after opening the can, because it came in like that pink can that they preserve evidence in, and she like was stumbling to talk because the smell was just overwhelming. She was just kind of like clearing her throat and like pausing, and it sounded like she was gonna get sick.
Oh my god.
D.C. Superior Court, the courthouse where Darren Wendt's trial took place, is situated in this massive limestone courthouse built in that boxy style of architecture that seems to be unique to government buildings of the 1970s. It's right next door to the headquarters of DC Police, and just a few blocks away from the National Mall and the rows of neoclassical government buildings that line Pennsylvania Avenue. There's no other court like it in the United States. The 61 judges who sit on the bench there are nominated by the president and must be confirmed by the Senate, just like judges to Federal Appeals Court, and yes, the Supreme Court. But the caseloads of DC Superior Court judges are about as far as you can get from the weighty constitutional issues being debated by the justices of the High Court just up the street. Inside Superior Court, the judges appointed by the President of the United States are overseeing trials involving everything from misdemeanors to murders. Despite its imposing facade and iconic location, DC Superior Court is basically a municipal court for the District of Columbia. And inside, that's exactly what it looks like. Most of the courtrooms are surprisingly small, cozy even. It only takes a few steps from the front of the attorney's tables to get to the witness stand, and there are just five or six rows of wooden benches for the public watching on from the gallery. They're so small that when the judge asks the lawyers to approach the bench to talk privately, they flip a switch, piping in this white noise over the court's sound system, so that the jurors and the reporters won't overhear anything they're not supposed to.
In Superior Court, one of the reasons the courtrooms are so small is there's so many of them because we bring about 15 to 18,000 prosecutions every year in Superior Court. Superior Court is where the hard work of justice gets done day after day in Washington, D.C.
That's Glenn Kirshner. He retired last summer after 30 years as a federal prosecutor. So he knows the courtrooms inside D.C. Superior Court well. He's tried scores of cases there.
But it's like a classroom almost. It's just not a big courtroom. So, yes, every piece of evidence is kind of up close and personal to the jurors. And that goes for guns and cartridge casings and clothes. That there's that dried blood smell on clothing that was worn by the victim when they were killed. And it is unmistakable. And it is really pungent in the worst possible way. So do you have to take all of that into account when, you know, and you don't want to invade the juror's space either. I've seen defense attorneys and prosecutors, in fairness, almost lean over the bar into the jury box, and people get really uncomfortable with that. So it is a very theatrical production, a trial, right? I mean, a murder trial is a play, and it's a very important play, and the rules mean everything, but it's still a production. So you do think about the theatrics of everything you do. You have to.
We were speaking with Glenn Kirshner not only because he knows what it's like to litigate inside a D.C. courtroom, but because he knows one of the key players quite well, Laura Bach, the lead prosecutor in the case.
The highest praise you can give a homicide prosecutor in Washington, D.C. is saying that she is a beast. Laura Bach is a beast of a prosecutor.
Laura Bach joined the U.S. Attorney's Office as a junior prosecutor when Glenn was the chief of the Homicide Division. They worked together on her first murder case in D.C. Superior Court. By the time Darren Wint's case went to trial, Laura Bach was no longer a rookie. She was a veteran litigator in the Homicide Division. Her co-counsel was an assistant U.S. attorney named Christopher Bruckman. Chris Bruckman delivered the government's opening statement, where he memorably described this as a case that nightmares are made of. Bruckman and Bach shared the duties of questioning and cross-examining witnesses. He was a sensitive and incisive questioner. But it was clear Laura Bach was steering the ship. We really wanted to talk with Laura Bach and Chris Bruckman for this podcast. After the trial, after Darren Wint was handed four life sentences, we reached out to the U.S. Attorney's Office about interviewing them. We followed up for months. But in the end, their spokesman, Bill Miller, denied our request to interview them because Darren Wint and his lawyers had filed paperwork to appeal his conviction. So, knowing we wouldn't get to talk to Laura Bach, Glenn was the next best thing. Her former boss, a man who knows her background, her style of litigating, and the role she had to play well.
She is the real deal. She's one of the best homicide prosecutors in the country. And I wouldn't say that if it wasn't true. And I had to pleasure of supervising her and working with her for well over a decade. So, I mean, here's what I'll say. if I ever, God forbid, lost one of my children, and I have six daughters and one son, I would want Laura Bach to prosecute the person responsible for taking my child from me.
If you saw Glenn in person, you might recognize him. He's been on TV a lot in recent months as a legal commentator. When he first came to the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. in the early 90s to work in the homicide division, his boss was a man named Robert Mueller. Yes, that Robert Mueller, who went on to lead the FBI and was then appointed special counsel in the Russia probe. See, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia, like D.C. Superior Court, is unique, too. There are nearly 100 U.S. Attorney's Offices across the country, responsible for representing the federal government and prosecuting federal crimes in court. But because of D.C.'s weird status as the capital, not just a city, but not actually a state, federal prosecutors working out of the U.S. Attorney's Office are also responsible for prosecuting local crimes within the district lines. That's why when Darren Wint was prosecuted, the case was called the United States versus Darren Wint. Over the years, Glenn Kirshner and Laura Bach worked together prosecuting several D.C. murder cases.
She is the kind of people person that whether she is dealing with a witness who is a scientist or a politician or a social worker or a crackhead or a dope fiend, and I say that with no disrespect, I love our crackheads and dope fiends. They are our witnesses. They're our victims. They're the people that we are here by and large to help and protect. And they're the ones who are in dark alleys late at night who see murders go down. Laura Bach has a way of connecting with those people, with everyone. And she has this sort of almost folksy approach when she's in court that plays really well kind of across the spectrum. She knows how to get along with defense attorneys. She knows how to persuade judges, and she knows how to talk with jurors.
Glenn says Laura Bach has a penchant for handling complex cases. She's a details person. About a decade ago, Laura Bach served as a lead prosecutor on what still stands as the longest trial in D.C. Superior Court history, the trial of six members of a D.C. gang known as the 22nd Street Crew. They were charged with murder, assault, and witness intimidation. The trial lasted 9 months, and all the men were convicted. Glenn Kirshner told us Laura Bach pours her heart and soul into just about every case. He told us during one particularly difficult murder case, Laura Bach heard one of her witnesses had been shot as they were waiting to go to trial. When she found out, she dropped what she was doing, hailed a cab, and rushed to the hospital to check on the witness. She wasn't thinking about her own safety. She was thinking only about her witness. Glenn says that's just how Laura operates. We saw that side of Laura Bach in the courtroom, too. She had a way of charging into the courtroom each morning, almost like she was ready to do battle. And she had a way of taking charge when she was questioning witnesses, too. You did not want to give her a weaselly answer if you were sitting on the witness stand. In that way, she almost reminded us of an elementary school principal. She favored conservative skirt suits, and she usually wore flats when she first got into the courtroom, but she diligently changed into a pair of pumps before the jury filed in. As Glenn mentioned, as serious as a murder trial is, it's also a performance. As spectators, we noticed all these little details that rounded out the characters we were seeing every day.
You see the outfits people are wearing and what, you know, this guy likes to drink Coke every day. And you almost feel like you kind of know, you know, I almost felt like I knew Laura Bach and I knew the third juror because you just, it's like you're all a part of it. And it was just a fascinating experience. It really was.
Yeah, it's a very, it's this unusually intimate endeavor between prosecutors, jurors, even the defendants and the judge. And yeah, it's a very strange dance that we do in those courtrooms.
Speaking of theatrics, there's actually a movie about one of the cases Laura and Glenn worked on together. It was a strange case involving a well-known D.C. socialite in her 90s who was murdered by her second husband, a man 44 years her junior, who was masquerading as a German nobleman. Seriously. There was no DNA or forensic evidence to support their case. It was all circumstantial. But Laura and Glenn won. The movie about the trial is called Georgetown. It was released in April. It stars Christoph Waltz and Annette Bening as the husband and wife. An actor named Paulino Nunez is playing Glenn Kirshner. But for some reason, there's no character based on Laura Bach. Screenwriters apparently wrote her out of the story. There are two other names you've heard throughout this podcast when we've talked about the trial. Darren Wint's lawyers, Judith Pipe and Jeffrey Stein. They both work at the District Public Defender Service, or PDS, as attorneys there call it. At the time of the trial, Jeff Stein was a supervising attorney at PDS. He's tall and thin, looks like he runs a lot. And he does. The whole time the trial was going on, it turns out Jeff Stein was training for a marathon, running to court and back home from court every day. And then 3 days after the jury rendered its verdict, he went on to win the Marine Corps Marathon. Jeff Stein was paired with Judy Pipe, an even more senior attorney at PDS. Judy Pipe is sharp, quick-witted, and comfortable in a courtroom. Of course, we originally wanted to interview Judy Pipe and Jeff Stein for this podcast. We wanted to hear from them what it was like to work this case from the other side, to defend a man charged with some of the most heinous murders in the city's history. But unfortunately for us, they work at the Public Defender Service, which has a policy its attorneys, even senior litigators like Judy Pipe, never talk to reporters. We spoke instead to Jason Downs, who used to work at PDS.
How does a case get assigned? How did she get that case?
Yeah, so I wasn't there when it was assigned, but I would imagine from when I was there, they would want that case to go to someone that has experience, not only handling big cases, but handling cases that are that have scientific components to them. And that's a difficult mix, right? You know, the science in this case, from what I understand looking out, was difficult looking from the outside in. You need a good lawyer, but you also need someone that is willing and able to dig into the science. And Judy had proven herself to be that type of lawyer even before this case.
We met Jason Downs on Capitol Hill in an old row home that had been refurbished into a small law office. He left the D.C. Public Defender Service in early 2015 to go into private practice in Baltimore. He's a standout himself, having worked a series of high-profile cases involving young black men killed at the hands of police. He was part of the legal team that represented the family of Freddie Gray, who was fatally injured in the back of a Baltimore police van in 2015. His death led to riots in the city. In the end, Downs and the other lawyers secured a $6.4 million settlement from Baltimore. Jason Downs knows PDS inside and out. Before he left, he was responsible for training all the new attorneys who started there. And he knows Judy well. He considers her a friend. He's worked cases with her. He's seen her in action in court when things are going her way and when they're not. He's seen how she interacts with clients and says she's passionate and genuine.
I have learned that most of my clients in the criminal world are probably more intelligent than most lawyers, right? They have much more savvy, much more in tune. And so our clients, criminal defendants, they can usually tell when you're BSing them, right? And Judy, I've never seen her have a problem with a client ever, because I think that our clients can tell that she genuinely cares. I think that when she walks in, she has a conversation with them, I think they know that she cares. And I think she goes out of her way to show that she cares. And that's harder than it seems for, you know, a white woman that probably grew up in a very different environment than many of our clients. So for her to be able to connect, and I've seen her do it, to be able to connect, it's just a sign of how genuine she really is.
We saw Judy's sincere authenticity during Darren Wint's trial. She had this ease about her in the courtroom when she was questioning witnesses, even the witnesses who really didn't want to be there. She seemed really smart, brainy, but also approachable. Judy Pipe would usually wear skirt suits with bigger earrings, usually hoops, and would make self-deprecating jokes during lulls as she tried to wrangle the projector to show photos or videos in the courtroom. As you've heard, we've spent a lot of time in the courtroom with these people, and you begin to notice little details. Jason Downs and Judy Pipe have a unique shared history. They actually started the Public Defender Service on the exact same day, back in 2007. As young attorneys, they had their sights set on the trial division. They were both itching to get inside a courtroom. But as with all new recruits, they first had to undergo an extensive training program.
I went through the program with Judy Pipe, and she was a superstar even then. Everyone could see it. There was no question. There were, I think, 8 of us going to the trial division, all of which were, you know, good friends because we were in this 10-week training program. So we were friends. But by nature, I think many lawyers by nature are competitive. It's just part of who lawyers are. Many of us are. And Judy stood out in a field of talented, competitive people. She was one of the people that stood out, no doubt.
Like personality-wise or skill-wise and all of it?
All of the above. So skill-wise, no question. So Judy's one of those scary people that has the combination of talent, and she'll put the hard work in as well. So, and she's sort of, you know, obsessive is the wrong word, but she'll stay up all night if she has to. So she's one of those overachievers that came in, you know, we thought it was a mock preliminary hearing. Judy thought it was life and death. And so she's preparing for this hearing as if someone could possibly go to jail. You know, this is just, you know, we're in a mock courtroom.
After they completed their training, they both headed to the trial division together. As new attorneys, Jason says their first step was investigating cases. They would hit the streets to re-examine crime scenes and independently interview as many witnesses as they could. Basically, their job was to check the police work to see if there was anything they missed or anyone they failed to talk to or couldn't find. The idea is to gather as much information as possible that they can then use in their client's defense when the case finally reaches the courtroom.
And Judy and I went out often, and she was a dogged investigator. She was creative. She wasn't afraid to knock on as many doors as it took. She was one of those people that said, well, look, if the incident happened at 10 o'clock at night in such and such neighborhood, then let's go at 10 o'clock at night and see the scene when it happened. She's that kind of person. She's been that way since we started in 2007.
Independent investigations by the defense are important because police and other investigators are essentially on the prosecution side. They, too, represent the government. And prosecutors are often allowed to keep the official investigation details, like witness statements and other documents, close to the vest before trial. So the defense kind of has to do its own digging to learn more about the case. PDS takes its obligation to investigate its cases seriously. But, Jason says, how good the investigation is depends largely on who's leading it. Jack found a PDS training manual online. Of course he did. It's more than 1,000 pages long and goes through basically every facet of how you can become a public defender in D.C. This is what the manual says about investigations. The importance of thorough investigation cannot be overemphasized. Counsel can never gather too many details concerning the facts and circumstances. The obscure or easily overlooked fact may become vital in the midst of trial. But not every public defender's office has the resources to carry out its investigations. Former Attorney General Eric Holder has called D.C.'s PDS the best public defender office in the country. Partly, that's because of the caliber of the talent it attracts. Practicing law in D.C., the nation's capital, is a draw for hungry young lawyers looking to prove themselves. Partly, it's because Washington, D.C. is a big stage. And partly, it's because of the funding PDS gets. It's also because of the innovative, aggressive way PDS tackles its cases. People who work there call themselves champions of liberty. It almost seems like something out of a Shonda Rhimes show. On their website, they say, everyone deserves someone in their corner. Before we talked to Jason, we hadn't really thought about the fact that the defense doesn't rely on the government's evidence. They seek out their own, too. Before the lawyers take on the case in the courtroom, they re-examine it from the ground up. Even with seemingly all the evidence pointing in one direction, their goal is to find something that doesn't fit. If they find enough that doesn't fit, they might have reasonable doubt. As we thought about what Jason told us, we realized reinvestigating the case is exactly what Judy Pipe did. She called to the stand witnesses whose testimony didn't fit the prosecution's case. In fact, she had multiple witnesses who seemed to directly contradict it. We've hinted at it already. The witness who saw Amy Savopoulos' blue Porsche when it was being driven out of D.C. into Maryland, a man named Andrew Zeron. Andrew Zeron saw the Porsche driving on New York Avenue, one of the major routes out of D.C. and into Prince George's County, Maryland. Pretty much any time of day, you're likely going to encounter bumper-to-bumper traffic there. And that's kind of what made the blue Porsche stick out, he said. Not only the fact that it was a nice car, and this witness knew cars, but he said he was a bit frustrated with the driver. No one was really moving in traffic, and despite that, he said, the Porsche was erratically weaving in and out of lanes, trying to cut around cars. only to end up just a single car ahead. It seemed very clear whoever was driving that Porsche was in a big rush. Zeron said he only saw the car for about 5 minutes in total, but he did catch a few glimpses of the driver. Judy Pipe called Andrew Zeron as defense witness one. His was the first story the jury heard that conflicted with the prosecution's narrative. He said he noticed the driver of the Porsche was a man, wearing a construction vest. But he said that detail stood out, because it didn't quite make sense to the witness. A guy in a construction vest, driving a $200,000 car? Zeron admitted he was in a hurry and a bit distracted himself. He was late to an appointment and said he didn't really get a good look at the driver. But he said it was a smaller guy driving the car. In fact, Zeron initially told authorities the driver was petite. Petite is probably not a word most people would use to describe Darren Wint in the spring of 2015. But the witness also noticed something else. Remember, in 2015, Darren had shoulder-length dreadlocks. Zeron said the person driving the Porsche had short, well-groomed hair. It wasn't the first time someone who didn't seem to look anything like Darren Wint was spotted during a key moment in this crime. The parking lot where the Porsche was burned, we told you right next to La Fontaine Blue Catering, surveillance cameras on the back of that building recorded a figure running from the direction of the car fire. You can see a large plume of smoke just barely in the shot. The video could be better. It's a bit grainy, and we don't get a good look at the person running. You can't see their face because they have a hood pulled up over their head, so you can't see what their hair looked like either. We can't really even tell if it's a man or a woman, but we see the person is carrying what looks like a white bucket. Judy Pipe asked the jury to take a closer look at that video. The person looks slim, not anything like the kind of person who spends a lot of time weightlifting in the gym. The video isn't perfect, but both the prosecution and the defense attorneys seem to agree. The person running away from the Porsche wasn't Darren Wint. When Judy Pipe began reinvestigating the case, she came up with an explanation for those pieces of evidence that don't fit. It wasn't Darren who committed the crimes. She said the real killers were still out there, and police hadn't done a thorough job ruling out other potential suspects. In legal circles, suggesting someone else is responsible for a crime is known as a Winfield defense. It actually gets its name from a case of a D.C. man named Reginald Winfield, who was convicted of murdering a woman in the 1990s. He successfully appealed his conviction on the grounds that the judge unfairly blocked his lawyer from introducing evidence suggesting someone else was responsible. Jason Downs told us in no uncertain terms, presenting a Winfield defense is difficult. A lot of lawyers try it, but not too many judges are keen to go along. The law doesn't allow defense attorneys to just stand up in court and point the finger at anybody. There's usually a whole series of steps a defense attorney has to go through to get a judge to let this type of defense proceed. And each of those steps can be thwarted by prosecutors. In the summer of 2018, the lawyers in the United States versus Darren Wint gathered in courtroom 203 for a pretrial hearing. It was still months before a jury would begin hearing the case. The reason for the hearing was that Judy Pipe and Jeff Stein wanted to get permission to introduce a Winfield defense. They wanted the judge's okay to present the idea that someone else had killed Sava, Amy, Vera, and Philip. Someone who police hadn't charged. But here's the catch. Judy Pipe didn't want to reveal to the prosecution who that someone was. Not surprisingly, Laura Bach and Chris Bruckman were dead set against it. There were a flurry of motions filed back and forth for most of the summer. Then, just over a month before the jury was seated, the judge ruled on Judy Pipe's Hail Mary. She'd allow it. The defense could move ahead with its plan to name alternate suspects. And they didn't have to share who they were planning to name. It was the first big detail to come out of the case since Darren's arrest 3 years earlier. But it was a cliffhanger. It's possible the prosecution didn't even know who the defense would name as an alternate suspect on the first day of the trial. In any trial, the prosecution delivers its opening statement first. And when Chris Bruckman got up there, It seems the prosecution was prepared to clear a man who had fallen under suspicion before, Sava's assistant. Bruckman said they'd prove Jordan Wallace was completely innocent. He didn't mention anyone else. Then it was the defense's turn. Jeff Stein stood up in the well of the courtroom and dropped a bombshell. He said it wasn't Darren Wint who should be on trial for murder. It was his brothers, Darrell and Stefan. It wasn't the only trick up their sleeve. Weeks later, Judy Pipe surprised the court with another tactical move, one you rarely see in murder cases. She called the man charged with the quadruple murder to testify in his own defense. Darren Wint took the stand. This podcast was written and produced by Jack Moore and me, Megan Cloherty. Julia Ziegler is our content advisor. Thanks to Carlos Prieto for his help calling Douglas Ventura. Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review. You can see some of the evidence, like Darren and Vanessa's texts, at 22hourspodcast.com. And we want to hear what you think. Send us any questions you have. We might use them in an upcoming episode. You can email podcast@WTOP.com or find us on Twitter at 22hourspod. Music for this episode is Haters Hate by Ramon Messam. Cast of Pods by Doug Maxwell, available in the YouTube audio library. Rhythmic Pulse, Closing My Eyes for a Moment, and Call Me by Daniel Birch, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 International. 22 Hours, An American Nightmare, is a production of WTOP in Washington, D.C.